On the program today, a little Fed, a little social media, and then we'll head down to Louisiana. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 4th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, one hates to start the new year off. And yes, I know we are already halfway through the first week, but you know what I mean. Nobody wants to begin 2023 with the Federal Reserve wagging its monetary policy finger at us again. But that is where we find ourselves today. The central bank released the minutes of its December meeting today, and hawkish is the word you're looking for here. Financial market slang for being real, real worried about inflation. The minutes show Chair Powell and his colleagues promising amongst themselves to do what it takes to get inflation back down to its target of 2%. Basically, no matter how long it takes, the minutes show. It's not a surprise. Powell has been saying that every chance he gets, but seeing it in print somehow focuses the mind, I suppose. One of the other things that Powell talks about a whole lot is the labor market and how robust it is, wage gains included. Speaking of which, 23 states raised their minimum wage on New Year's Day, either by legislation or voter referendum or through an automatic cost of living increase to existing wages. Those raises range from 23 cents in Michigan to an extra buck and a half in Nebraska. That's per hour, obviously. The Economic Policy Institute figures more than 8 million people got an increase, which will help, inflation being what it is. Thing is, though, that wages have been going up overall in this tight labor market, about 5% over the past year. So do minimum wage increases really help all that much? Marketplace's Savannah Marr has that one.
Lately, low-wage workers in sectors like fast food and hospitality have been able to insist on much more than their local minimum wage.
These workers have seen their wages increase at a higher pace, actually, than workers at the higher end of the income spectrum,
says Molly Kinder, a fellow at the Brookings Institution. But in the coming year, many economists expect the job market to weaken.
It's entirely possible that workers will not have the same leverage to command pay increases as they did in 2022.
She says raising the minimum wage ensures wage gains aren't lost during an economic downturn. And even in a tight labor market,
there's always going to be some group of workers that are making that minimum wage.
David Cooper is with the Economic Policy Institute.
Maybe those folks have limited job options because of a disability or a health condition. Maybe they have transportation restrictions. Maybe they have childcare restrictions.
Cooper says raising the wage floor protects those workers who don't have as much weight to throw around. The catch, according to Michael Strain with the American Enterprise Institute, is that boosting the minimum wage can mean fewer low-wage and entry-level job openings.
I think now would be a bad time to increase the costs to employers of hiring those workers.
The federal minimum wage, by the way, is not increasing. It stands at $7.25 an hour, where it's been since 2009. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Prices are going up in many parts of this economy, as you know, including the government. U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, USCIS, the federal agency in charge of immigration and citizenship, is proposing a set of fee increases that would affect a whole range of immigration applications because, the agency says, it needs the money, getting, as it does, 96% of its funding not from Congress, but from filing fees. Marketplace's Lily Jamali explains what's going on here.
USCIS revenue dropped by 40% early in the pandemic when the number of applications fell. So did staffing, at a time when the agency was already behind on processing existing applications, says Cornell Law's Stephen Yale Lair.
The USCIS needs to increase fees to dig itself out of its backlog.
But he says the proposal to steady its finances could be a burden for businesses. Chev Dalal Dehaney of the American Immigration Lawyers Association points to a new $600 fee on employers looking to hire foreign workers. That money would go towards an unrelated cost, processing the claims of people seeking asylum.
This unfortunately could have the negative impact of deterring companies from investing in the United States. It could deter foreign workers who we consider maybe the best and the brightest from coming and bringing their skills and their knowledge to the United States.
She says the new fees could price smaller businesses and nonprofits out of the nation's immigration system. And the plan to charge employers for the cost of the asylum program raises questions about the agency's fee-based funding, says Ron Hira of Howard University.
Just from a good governance standpoint, if you're going to charge user fees, they should reflect the true costs of adjudicating those specific applications rather than doing lots of cross-subsidization.
In a statement, USCIS said, quote, Congress could reduce the burden on our fee-paying customers by fully funding our humanitarian mission. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, yes, there were the Fed minutes. They were not popular with traders. Also, the regular JOLTS report, job openings and labor turnover survey. Still, about 10.5 million open jobs in this economy, but caveat emptor on that one. We have seen companies just keeping jobs open longer, just not hiring. Anyway, stocks, bonds, details when we do the numbers. You know how for almost as long as digital advertising's been a thing, Google and Meta have hoovered up almost all the digital ad spending? Well, no more. Last year, for the first time since 2014, Google and Meta together brought in less than half of all U.S. digital advertising spending. And yes, it is still many billions and billions of dollars, but it's a real shift. Some of it's about Apple's new privacy policies, and some of it's about advertisers moving to streaming, but a lot of it is about how social media is changing and how all the different platforms influence how we shop. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has more on that.
My TikTok is here to suggest a solution to a very specific problem.
We all know the struggle of running low on toothpaste and trying to use every last bit in the tube. So with this device, you can just twist and it squeezes all the toothpaste right out.
I'm not sure if this video is part of a marketing campaign, but Courtney Spritzer, CEO of the marketing agency Socialfly, says it may have started that way. Her clients' ad spending on TikTok has doubled in the last year.
Brands can either post content organically to reach their audience, or they could hire creators or influencers to create content on behalf of their brand.
And once those products start trending, other TikTokers review the same ones. Embarrassing admission, I bought the stupid toothpaste squeezer. And when I did, I went straight from the influencer shopping link in her profile to Amazon. Caitlin Sikowski is a marketing analyst at Mintel.
The ad is actually reaching you at point of sale. So it's making it super easy for you to click into something and purchase it immediately.
Eliminating what used to be a more common part of online shopping, Google search. Sucharita Kadali is a retail analyst at Forrester.
People use Amazon as a product search engine instead of Google.
Still, she says Google is a big part of the ad business, especially when it comes to product reviews. Not everyone's going to trust an influencer when they're considering more expensive items like an air fryer or that darn Dyson Airwrap that takes up half my feed. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
If inflation was the economic story of 2022, which it was, shrinkflation is probably the unsung economic story of every year going on decades now. You've seen it, right? The yogurt container that weighs less but never gets less expensive. The rolls of toilet paper that have just a few fewer squares on them than they used to but never cost fewer dollars. Well, there is a person out there who's on a mission to make sure consumers know how much less they are getting. Edgar Dworsky's been cataloging shrinkflation for a very long time now, and we got him on the phone. Mr. Dworsky, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
You have been profiled in the New York Times, where we found you. John Oliver did a whole segment on you. You have been called the foremost expert, I think, on shrinkflation in this economy. And I want to know how one becomes that expert. How did this happen?
I think you start out as a kid who pays attention to the candy bars that he buys and the toilet paper that he uses. And you see the candy bar was getting smaller and the Charmin toilet paper was having fewer sheets. And that's kind of how I got into it.
One might call this a calling then, since you've been doing it since you were a kid.
Yeah, some people are called to check on shrinking products, and I guess right. I fit the bill.
You're it. Do me a favor, though, would you, and help me understand, and we should preface this. I should preface this by saying you've spent your life in consumer protection. Give me the impetus behind the calling, right? Because there's a real reason you do this.
Well, I think shrinkflation is a nasty way to pass on a price increase. It's just a sneaky practice of manufacturers, and I consider myself a consumer educator, and I want people to know some of the tricks of the trade. So if a manufacturer is reducing the number of ounces in their detergent, and it went from 100 ounces to 90, it's done so inconspicuously that most people won't notice. That's where I come in.
There's also this thing called skimpflation, which, even though this is my line of work, was news to me when I first started doing research for this subject. And I want you to tell me about, oh man, and I can't remember the name, but it's the fake butter that changed the ingredient, and there was a consumer outcry, and then they had to go back. And I ask about it because my wife uses it, and she was really annoyed.
Basically, skimpflation is when a manufacturer reformulates a product using cheaper ingredients or less of the good ingredient. And in the case of Smart Balance, it's a premium spread. It costs about $5 for a 15-ounce mm-hmm, container. Mm-hmm. The original version had 64% oil. They inconspicuously changed that little 64% number that appears in the bottom left-hand corner of the front panel of their product and made it 39% oil. Well, consumers noticed. And actually, as of this week, there are over 2,200 one-star reviews for Smart Balance on the website. And they say, you know, we apologize. We were changing the formula to try to make it spread more easily.
Yeah,
give me a break. Spread more easily. They were trying to fatten their bottom line by using less oil, which is very expensive now. But they heard the outcry. And now on store shelves, we're starting to see the old 64% come back just as inconspicuously as it changed to a smaller one. So you got to look very carefully to see, are you getting the old junky one or are you getting the new, much better one?
Are you, you're not philosophically opposed to price increases, right? If companies need to increase prices, they got to increase prices. Just don't do it sneakily, right? Is that the gist here?
I agree. I mean, we all kind of hate what's going on in the supermarket these days. Every time you go, you know, there's a new higher price on the items you buy all the time. It's a fact of life. But if you don't know a price increase is being passed on to you because they do it in the sneaky way, that's where I see the issue.
No product is safe, right? I mean, it goes everywhere.
Well, there's one product.
What?
I always say it will have gone too far if I open that carton of eggs and there's only 11 inside.
Well, they'd have to reconfigure the whole carton thing and everything. Oh, forget it. They're never doing that. Edgar Dworsky, he is a consumer advocate at heart since he was a little kid. He runs two websites. One's called consumerworld.org and the other one is mouseprint.org. Mr. Dworsky, thanks for your time, sir. I do appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Coming up.
We've had 17 floods in 17 years since Katrina.
That is a lot of floods. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 133 today, 0.4%, 33,269. The NASDAQ up 71 points, just under 0.7%, 10,458. The S&P 500 up 28 points, 0.75%, 38.52 there. Salesforce, which said today it would cut 10% of its staff in the coming weeks, is one of the latest software and tech companies to announce layoffs. Its stock gained 3.5% because that's the way capitalism works. Vimeo also said it would be cutting 11% of its workforce. Its shares added just over 4%. Bond prices were up. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.69%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I talked about jolts up at the top of the program real quick, how the labor market in this economy is still pretty tight right now, tighter certainly than the Fed might like it to be. To be clear, though, we have been seeing layoffs in some sectors, technology, media, finance as well. But whether a business is likely to lay people off doesn't just depend on what it does. It also depends on that company's size. Compared to this time last year, and we learned this in the JOLTS report this morning, layoffs have picked up the most among the smallest of small businesses, companies with less than 10 people. Marketplace's Justin Ho has been looking into what small businesses are so nervous about, and he started with a bicycle shop in Murrieta, California.
The shop's called Element 6. It focuses on repairing expensive carbon fiber bike frames, and it does custom paint jobs. Jesse Larrabee is carefully sanding down a carbon frame by hand to get it ready for painting.
You got to make sure you keep the same shape of the frame and you make sure you don't eat into the carbon at all.
Larrabee says it's pretty tedious. The process can take 2 to 3 hours, and learning to do it right wasn't easy. It
took about 2 to 3 months for me to feel comfortable sanding and getting the hang of not damaging anything while I do it.
Larrabee is one of Element 6's 3 employees. They and the 3 owners are the only people who work for the company. Irvin Soyanko is one of the owners. He manages the day-to-day. He says the company spent a fair amount of time and effort training those 3 employees.
There's been a lot of growing pains, I guess, because painting bikes is actually really difficult. And it took some time for them to forget bad habits and learn new techniques.
Business is pretty good. The shop has a room full of bikes and frames that need to be repaired and painted. But Soyanko says he's worried about what could happen if the broader economy slows down.
A big part of our business, like custom paint, is not really a need. It's more of a want. And when budgets get constrained, those kinds of things are probably first to go.
And if that happens, Soyanko says he might have to let go of those 3 employees he's been training.
I mean, if no bikes are coming in, we'll be forced to, because at the end of the day, this is a business and we need to be convinced that there's potential in the, at least in the medium term. But if we can't get through the short term, then we'll have to make some tough decisions.
The problem for tiny businesses like Element 6 is that if the economy goes bad in the short term, they can't just wait things out.
You know, the small business has to get on with it.
That's Glenn McDonald, an economics professor at Washington University in St. Louis. He says larger businesses, on the other hand, can wait things out.
Because, you know, laying people off and getting them back and all that sort of stuff, it's expensive. So they'd rather not do that until it's really justified.
Larger businesses also have more resources they can draw on if things go south.
If you're Anheuser-Busch or something like that, you have a very deep pocket. There's lots of money. There's, you know, credit markets are well established for big companies and so forth. So not a big deal.
But smaller businesses don't really have those options. As a result,
everyone is being more mindful of cash and holding on to cash.
That's Laurelyn Wilson. She runs an accounting firm called Lake Oswego Tax in Oregon. And she says businesses with fewer than 10 employees tend to have a harder time building up cash because they don't bring in that much revenue.
And so then when you take out rent costs, employee costs, cost of goods, their margins aren't usually that high.
Wilson says a lot of small businesses are looking for ways to bring down those costs.
And a lot of people are locked into leases, so payroll is almost always the line item that will get cut first.
At Element 6 in Murrieta, Irvin Soyanko walked me over to another worker sanding a different carbon frame. He's about to bust out a tool with a little more power.
So usually we don't use that because it can eat into the carbon, but he knows what he's doing.
The worker using the sander, John Fuentes Venero, says he's not too worried about what'll happen if the economy slows down.
From learning from Element 6, I think if something ever happens, I think I'm able to go apply another bicycle shop because they're teaching me something. I can add now something to my toolbox.
And even though Venero is relatively new to the bike industry, he's been painting cars since he was a kid. And between bike repair and auto body shops, he says everyone needs painters. In Murrieta, California, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
If you live by the ocean or by a river that's close enough to the ocean, you're probably already thinking about this. But sea level rise, because the planet is getting hotter, is making that coastal living more dangerous. And if people want to keep living on the water, some communities are just going to have to elevate, literally just elevate everything. By one estimate, something like 3 or 4 million buildings in river and coastal towns in this economy are at risk. And in Louisiana, it gets even worse. A combination of sea level rise and sinking ground level is threatening towns on the shore of Lake Pontchartrain, which can flood when storms push water into it from the Gulf of Mexico. From our climate podcast, How We Survive, Marketplace's Amy Scott visited one community that is racing to adapt.
Hop on the narrow Lake Pontchartrain Bridge in New Orleans, drive 35 miles north across the lake, and you'll get to the historic resort town of Mandeville. Right on the shore, just yards from the water, sits a stately white house with an American flag in the front yard. The style is typical Louisiana Creole, with a deep front porch and big black storm shutters. Only what used to be the ground floor is now 15 steps up.
Well, y'all come on in and sit down. Can we offer you some ice water?
Like some water?
Leonard and Becky Rohrbaugh own this house. It was built in 1843. It's been in Leonard's family since the early 1900s, and it's survived a lot of storms.
Well, Katrina was the worst.
In 2005, when this house was just 3 feet off the ground, Hurricane Katrina sent waves from the lake rushing under the house, inches from going inside.
The streets just look like pickup sticks, telephone poles, trees, power wires everywhere. It took us 45 minutes climbing up and over and under trees to get to the house to discover that it was still here.
But the foundation was badly damaged. Then 7 years later, Hurricane Isaac roared through, bringing the lake once again nearly into their house and eating away at the foundation.
We said, okay, we got to go up.
So up they went. In 2016, they hired a contractor to dig tunnels under the house, lift it with hydraulic jacks, and build a new, higher foundation underneath.
And we'd go to a few blocks away to the house where we were renting to stay while this was going on. And every night I would just pray that my house didn't topple over.
The whole process took about 3 months and $250,000, which they covered with some small grants and a low-interest disaster loan. Becky had just retired as a banker. Leonard used to work in the oil industry. They used the space underneath the house for storage. It's covered with a decorative lattice. From the outside, it looks like a totally normal and attractive house. And when Ida hit last year and devastated the region, they fared okay.
Lake Pontchartrain just flows under our house and out the backyard. And then when this wind's done, it all goes back down into Lake Pontchartrain. Gravity takes over. And that makes it a lot easier to clean up.
Mandeville is a charming town, full of historic buildings and the world's oldest continuously operating jazz hall. But in the past few decades, it's faced regular flooding from rising seas and more intense storms.
We've had 17 floods in 17 years since Katrina.
Roderick Scott is a longtime Mandeville resident and board chairman of the Flood Mitigation Industry Association. He says in the years since Katrina, more than 85% of buildings in the lake surge zone have been elevated.
Mandeville is the laboratory, and we literally are lifting two or three right now. Every month, a couple of them go up.
At first, as with any lab, he says there were mistakes. We walk by what must have been a cute wooden house now perched way up on these oversized brick columns with cars parked underneath. It's kind of like you're seeing into someone's garage.
We've got some ugly ones that came up first, and we realized right away we didn't want to do that again.
Since then, the town has adopted architectural guidelines. Mandeville is a pretty wealthy town, and a lot of homeowners have paid for their own elevations. FEMA grants and a federal loan program starting next year will help others. But with at least a couple feet of sea level rise expected by the end of the century, Scott says moving up only buys so much time.
We feel the rate at which the sea level is rising, that we've got two more mortgage cycles at the shore before we have to move buildings back.
That's about 60 years. The good news, he says, is once you've lifted a house off the ground, it's easier to move it to a new location in the future. In Mandeville, Louisiana, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Amy and her team took some pictures of those elevated houses in Mandeville while they were down there. You can see them and you can hear more stories of how we survive at marketplace.org or on the podcast platform of your choice. Thank you. final note on the way out today, we will leave the maneuvering going on in the House of Representatives to our political reporter colleagues. But it is worth pointing out here that eventually the House is going to have to vote on raising the debt limit, currently set at $31.4 trillion. Right now, by the way, we're in the hole to the tune of about $31.35 trillion, if you're curious. Anyway, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen does have a bunch of bookkeeping stuff she can do to keep the government afloat. But what is called the X date for the debt limit, the date that Yellen just runs out of cash, is, according to the Bipartisan Policy Center, not going to hit us till the third quarter of this year. All right, we got to go. Too much talking, not enough time, I suppose. So no moment of economic context today, and we'll make it up for you tomorrow. How about that? Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APN.